Iranians head to the polls to choose a new president. Four candidates are running for the post. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, says people's participation in the election helps the country gain major advantages at the international level. Israeli forces attack Palestinian protesters marching in Jerusalem Al-Quds against a controversial rally by settlers earlier this week. Hello and welcome. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Oh, it's election day in Iran and people are heading to the polls across the country to choose a new president for the next 4 years. More than 59 million Iranians are eligible to cast their ballots. Voters will choose a successor to incumbent President Hassan Rouhani. Four candidates are running for the post after three dropped out of the race on Wednesday. People are also voting in the country's city and village council elections. Midterm elections for parliament and assembly of experts will also be held concurrently in a number of cities. Now, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has cast his ballot in the country's presidential election. Ayatollah Khamenei called for a high turnout in the vote. Iran's leader said people's participation in elections helped the country gain major advantages on the international level. Therefore, he said, every single vote that is cast is important. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani cast his ballot also. He said then called on people from all walks of life to participate in the election. Rouhani said a high turnout will frustrate Iran's enemies. Yunus Hamami Lalazar is the religious leader of Jews in Iran. He says the Jewish community has been integrated into Iranian society despite the enemy's attempts to divide them.
There are several elections today, and the presidential election is the most important one that chooses the chief executive of the country. And based on the decisions made by the president will be part of the destiny of the nation. And we are part of the Iranian society, and we have come here to make the best choice. And we want to choose the best individual for this position, because actually to participate in the election is a right, it's an obligation, and every citizen has the right to play his role and have his share in order to make the best choice. That's an old policy of divide and rule. That's been a policy to create a rift, and they want to, in this way, proceed with their wishes. We are somehow entangled with a war. It was the post-war in the past, and we could see the enemy using weapons against you, attacking you. But in recent years, there's been an economic war due to the tyrannical sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation. In the meantime, they want to portray themselves as friends, but the Iranian nation is vigilant. During the years of imposed war, all the strata of the society from different religions, by following the path of the Imam, the people became united. And today we have to follow the leader and stay united and make the best choice in order to come up with the best results.
Political analyst Mohammed Marandi says elections are regularly held in Iran as part of efforts to uphold democracy, despite the fact that certain countries are seeking to undermine those efforts.
When one takes into account the fact that Iran is facing maximum pressure sanctions, when the region, thanks to the United States and its allies, has been in chaos and is partially destroyed from Afghanistan to Iraq to Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, Yemen, Libya, wherever you look, the Americans have brought about destruction. All of that has impacted us. We are surrounded by military bases. We see hundreds of Persian language media outlets owned or funded by Western regimes and the Saudis working day and night to undermine the country. Under those circumstances, the Iranians carry out regular elections, which are, there is very open debate. When you look at the three debates we had on television, the candidates upset almost everything that you can hear, even when you watch Persian language Western media outlets. A lot of what was said on Iranian TV was the same as what they say, but in a more polite way.
Well, meanwhile, Iranians in London are voting also. Let's cross over to London and talk to Robert Carter and see what's going on there. Robert, how you doing? Tell us what's happening in London on election day today.
Well, I'm doing very well, despite the poor weather. Unfortunately for Iranian voters, they just missed a two-week heat wave, which has come to an end as of last night. So the weather is pretty poor, but that hasn't dampened spirits here for Iranians who are coming out in decent numbers, by the looks of it, to vote from here in the UK. Now, you may hear the noise behind me. There is some dissidents and ragtag minority groups here which have come out to essentially try and intimidate Iranian voters who are trying to enter into the consulate to partake in the Islamic Republic's democratic process. But obviously we're not going to focus on them, despite their attempts to harass and intimidate ordinary Iranians who are interested in engaging in the democratic process of their country. There are still people coming out here. Voting began, or at least the doors of the consulate opened to vote, to receive voting at about 10 a.m. local time, and it's believed to continue until about 7 o'clock in the evening. But obviously depending on people still maybe queuing up, they could extend that time as well. Some interesting points to mention from over here in the UK. There are 11 locations which have been set up to receive voters across the country, five of which are located in London, where, of course, outside the consulate building, which is one of those locations. But also other major cities, including Manchester, Newcastle, Glasgow, which is a Scottish city, they have also got spots open for Iranians to take part and submit their votes. So still early hours. We expect to see more people coming down as the day progresses. But ultimately, this is just an example of an opportunity, really, for the Iranian people to combat the negative propaganda which circulates around the Islamic Republic. And a lot of those propaganda narratives, such as, you know, Iran is allegedly undemocratic and all that type of stuff, they come from places like the UK and America. So the fact that we are here seeing Iranians partaking in the democratic process, one of the healthiest and most prosperous democracies in that entire region, it's really knocking back and debunking that Western-peddled narrative against Iran.
Appreciate you being with us, Robert Carter in London. I'll probably be checking back with you in a bit. Well, meanwhile, talks to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are ongoing in Vienna, with the sides appearing to be close to an agreement. We discuss the issue with our guests in the News Review program. Let's take a listen.
Iran's chief negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, says the talks on reviving the 2015 nuclear deal have come closer than ever to fruition. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Araghchi noted that some essential issues are still being hammered out. He said Tehran wants to make sure that the U.S. will not repeat its unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal with Iran. The Kremlin says the Russian President Vladimir Putin has told his U.S. counterpart that he expects Washington to fully return to the accord known as the JCPOA. Iran, along with the European Union and six world powers, thrashed out a landmark accord in 2015 after years of negotiations. However, the U.S. pulled out of the deal in 2018, reimposing sanctions against Iran. Tehran says it wants all sanctions removed in a verifiable manner. Joining us now for the News Review is Divya Yahubian, professor of history out of Cal State University, San Bernardino, California, and Dr. Wilmer Leon, columnist and political scientist, joining us from the U.S. Capitol, Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Dr. Leon, we're going to start with you. Welcome to Press TV once again, sir. Your thoughts on where you think JCPOA talks hang right now?
Well, listening to the Iranian head of negotiations, it sounds like things are pointing in the right direction. I don't think that it's an accident or it's merely a coincidence that these conversations or this positive outlook comes on the heels of the G7, since a number of the signatories to the agreement are, in fact, members of the G7, and it's very good to hear also on the heels of the summit between Russian President Putin and U.S. President Biden that President Putin is saying that he expects the U.S. to return, and I don't think that that's an accident either. The United States needs to get back into this. The United States needs to get back into this yesterday, and the sooner it does, the better it's going to be for the entire world.
Thank you, Dr. and David Yahoubian. I'd like to welcome to the program now, Professor David there. The things that could actually impact it as of late could have been that summit between Vladimir Putin and the new U.S. President Joe Biden, the G7 summit. There could also possibly be the Iranian elections. What do you see impacting if there is actual true progress in talks and if we're on the precipice possibly of a real deal, a real revival of the deal?
Well, the Biden administration needs this. It needs a foreign policy win, if you will. And this is because it has essentially doubled down on all of the failed foreign policy initiatives of the Trump administration, Venezuela, Cuba, Yemen, Syria, its Israel policy, its aggression towards Russia and China. And I believe that this is how it links to the G7 conference, irrespective of any positive commentary related to the exchange between Putin and Biden. The United States made it clear at the G7 that Russia is to be perceived and treated as a threat and China as a challenge. And so in that context, the United States desperately needs a foreign policy win, if you will, and if not a win, just to take the Iran issue off the table for American foreign policy elites so they can focus on this new Cold War 2.0 that they're trumpeting against Russia and China simultaneously. So certainly Abbas Araghchi's commentary, as well as that of Mikhail Ulyanov, the Russian IAEA ambassador regarding tangible progress, these are positive statements, and they accord with what I believe is a desperate American need to return to the JCPOA so that it can focus on other foreign policy issues in its broader foreign policy agenda. I don't see that foreign policy agenda as being positive or plausible, but nevertheless, this might support a verifiable return of the United States to its commitments under the JCPOA.
And what's your level of optimism, Dr. Wilmer Leone, that there will be a revival of this accord?
I am still incredibly skeptical. I think my colleague is absolutely right that the Biden administration does need a foreign policy win here. The problem is the internal politics, the domestic politics, even the intra-party politics, because for as much as you have the perception that Democrats are supposed to be liberal, they can be some of the most disgustingly hawkish members of the American government. And so there is a large contingent of Democrats that are pressuring Biden in the opposite direction.
Hello again. Welcome back. Here we interrupt the normal course of our program to have the special coverage of Iran's 13th presidential election. And in this regard, we go live over to Press TV headquarters where Press TV anchor is talking to Robert Carter, Press TV's reporter in London. Let's take a listen.
Which have decided to send their goons down here to essentially try and upset the democratic process in the UK. I can confirm that the consulate building was vandalized today by these protesters as they were throwing paint at not only the building itself, but also security who had been hired by the consulate to protect decent, ordinary Iranian people who want nothing more than to participate in the Iranian democratic process. I've also witnessed innocent Iranian citizens who, including old ladies, for example, who have been harassed and suffered the most horrific and vile language and verbal abuse that you can imagine. It's far too graphic for me to give you an example on camera. But despite this hardship and despite some horrific weather that we've experienced this morning, Iranians have been coming down in good numbers to submit their vote. So ultimately, if that isn't an example of a clear victory for the Iranians, for the Islamic Revolution, in terms of people coming out despite further hardships that they suffer here in the West, defending their country, being patriotic, being proud and open Muslims as well, then I don't know what is. In terms of some interesting information I can give you about the setup here in the UK, there are at least 11 locations up and down the UK which have been set up to receive Iranian voters. There are at least 5 of those spread out across London, the consulate being one of those locations. There is also other major cities which have spots set up to receive Iranian votes, including major cities like Manchester and Newcastle, just to name a few, and also in Scotland, in Glasgow as well, another example where Iranians have the chance to come out and vote. So ultimately, this is an example of healthy Iranian democracy being expressed, yet in the UK at least, the British authorities have failed to protect Iranian voters, and the UK often claims that they are a defender of democracy on the world stage, but what I've witnessed here today is an absolute shambles on the part of the British authorities, who have failed by and large to protect Iranians who want to vote from harassment by Western-backed radicals and fanatics, and also they failed to protect the Iranian consulate building from vandalism, and even staff at the embassy, security at the embassy, have also been hit by this paint, which is a form of assault. So a disgraceful display by the British authorities, but a fantastic display by proud and patriotic Iranians who have braved these obstacles to still come and submit their votes here today.
Thanks a lot, Robert. Press TV's Robert Carter joining us from the British capital, London. Well, it's election day in Iran, and people are heading to the polls across the country to choose a new president for the next 4 years. More than 59 million Iranians are eligible to cast ballots.
Brilliant.
Around 7,200 polling stations have been set up across the country as voters will choose a successor to incumbent President Hassan Rouhani. Four candidates are still in the mix. To get a better understanding of the significance of the 13th presidential election in Iran, we're now joined by political commentator Mr. Masoud Shajareh, who's joining us now from the British capital, London, as well. Mr. Shajareh, welcome to the program. Give us your thoughts on the significance of this presidential election that we're in right now, and help our viewers better understand what's at stake in the ballot boxes right now.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It really is amazing significant, especially in that region. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the Islamic Revolution took place for empowering of the ordinary people in Iran. And this sort of manifestation of democracy in the region was done despite all the opposition by United States and Western powers, who were supporting the Shah and the kingship and that sort of illegitimate, unrepresentative system, which was there to benefit the West rather than the ordinary people in Iran. And now we are seeing really the similar thing. Really, Iran is the only country in the region which actually has got democracy. Sometimes people refer to Zionist state, but Zionist state is an apartheid system. You can't have an apartheid system and then have real democracy. Democracy in, over there is only for a very small section of the community who are occupying the lands of the Palestinians. While in Iran, it really is a truly democracy people actually coming and taking the event and the future in their own hand and being empowered. And it's a religious democracy. It's different to the secular democracy, but nevertheless, it's functioning. It's supported. It's popular. It came through the popularity and through a vote of everyone in a referendum. And indeed, it exists and will continue existing as long as it's supported by people. There is a double standard and the hypocrisy going on. I mean, Robert Carter was just reporting from outside the consulate, but you know, other places in London and elsewhere in Europe, you're seeing people who are opponent of Islamic Republic, and as a matter of fact, there are supporters of either being promoted by the Saudis or by the Americans or by other powers who see themselves an opponent of the Islamic Republic. These guys are they say that there is no democracy in Iran, and then at the same time they're trying to stop people actually going and voting, and they're intimidating them, they're bullying them. We've seen it in London and elsewhere. People are being really intimidated in a very vicious way to stop them voting, and then at the same time they actually complain that they say that the system in Iran, the government hasn't got support. So really, they're trying to create a news and then sort of promote it and to undermine the will of the people. And I think what one thing that is definitely very significant is the fact that the elections in Iran since the revolution has taken place despite any sort of crisis. At the time when there was a war, imposed war of Iraq, still the elections weren't delayed even for 1 hour or 1 day. Election took place at their time and indeed supported by the majority. And I think that is very significant for the region, because let's say all these Western powers led by United States who sort of complain about lack of democracy in Iran, who is their darling in the region? Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Emirates, I don't know how you could even refer to them as a government. These regimes are run by stooges of the United States who, indeed, if there is democracy tomorrow, they all will be removed, every single one of them. And they know it, and this is why they are opponent of any form of democracy or empowerment of people in their country.
Author and journalist Robert Fantina is joining us now from Kitchener, Ontario. Mr. Fantina, welcome to the program. Let's start off with getting your perspective on the importance of the 13th presidential election and what it means for the region.
Every presidential election in any country is certainly important, as is this one. Now, Iran is facing a number of challenges, mainly caused by the United States and its unfair and unjust policies toward Iran, toward much of the world. So part of one of the items that people will be looking at as a result of this election is how it might change the negotiations of the JCPOA, the international agreement that the United States unilaterally withdrew from in 2017. The idea that Iran is having democratic elections is displeasing to the United States because it wants to continue to demonize Iran and say that it's a dictatorship, that it's a government run by religious zealots. This is, of course, a complete myth, and the fact that Iran is having these elections proves that. So these elections are significant, as any presidential elections are. They will usher in a new leader. Some Iranians will be pleased with the results, some will not be. That is typical in any democracy. But the people of Iran like their government. They have established a form of government that is of their choosing. So a leader may be popular with some members, not popular with others, but it is the government that the people support.
Let's talk about the importance of the issue of the voter turnout. Turning to Mr. Shajari in London, many have been adamant that a strong turnout, it can be very fruitful, it has a lot of positive effects, it can foil plots, one of them being foiling plots of Iran's adversaries. That was also a comment echoed by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. He said that the people's participation in the elections helps the country gain major advantages at the international level. Unpack that for us, please.
One of the significant aspects of the last 12 election, presidential election in Iran, has been the extremely high turnout of participants. And as I said, even at the time of when the bombs and rockets were being dropped on Iran on the election days by Saddam Hussein. And that actually has given the real legitimacy and sealed the concept that the governments in Iran are not just approved, but supported and indeed chosen by the people. And that is very significant. I have to say that, you know, this coming election, it's because of the corona and the other issues, we might get smaller number of participants. But the fact of the matter is, what is really very significant, as previous reporters were actually saying, that the issue is indeed the issue of economy. And any government anywhere in the world, when it comes to their election, then economy is playing one of the most significant aspects of people supporting the government, and is a very important issue for everyone. In this particular election in Iran, I think what we are facing is that it's not that the fact that, you know, Rouhani's government wasn't concerned about the economy, but what manifests itself very clearly was that Mr. Rouhani was seeing the solution to the improvement of the economy in Iran through negotiation and indeed removal of sanctions. While Mr. Raisi's main concern is that there has to be resistant economy. Economy of Iran cannot wait for removal of sanctions and other things. We really need to be self-reliant on our own economy in Iran for it to improve, or indeed to change and improve the economy. And I think this is really one of the key points that people are actually voting on. People are voting from the sort of the concept of improvement through sort of waiting for better negotiation, better relationship, as a means of resolving the problems in economical problems in Iran, or indeed doing it the way that through resistant economy, through internal changes, through sort of not holding your breath waiting for the West changing their perception towards Iran. And I think ordinary people have come to the realization that the West is never going to be having negotiations and indeed finding a solution or helping Iran on an equal footing. And that sort of colonialism and colonial interests and colonial perceptions and so forth, it's always going to play when it comes between Iran and Western powers negotiation. So I think this is what people are going to choose. If people indeed, according to what is being reported now, they go for Mr. Raisi, what they're choosing is actually self-reliance, resistance economy, improving the situation, and not holding one's breath for waiting for new negotiation or end of the sanctions. And I think people in Iran over the last two president Rouhani's term have come to the conclusion that really that theory that the solution in Iran will come out of the negotiation with the United States has actually been defeated in hearts and minds of people.
Robert Fantina, I saw you nodding there. Would you like to add anything to the comments made by Mr. Shajani?
Yes, certainly. I agree with what he has said. I also think that the election of Mr. Raisi will strengthen Iran's position in the JCPOA simply because Iran will not be as anxious to reenter it. It will certainly be open to it if the United States is willing to abide by the original rules, the original agreement. But this is not a candidate or won't be a president who is going to attempt to appease the United States in any way. If the United States wants to reach out to Iran in a diplomatic and a fair manner to trade with Iran, to exchange academics and so on, then that will happen. However, because a new Iranian government will seek, as your other commentator said, to assure that the Iranian economy can be strong within itself and does not rely on the West, which can't be trusted, as the United States has shown repeatedly, and most recently in with President Biden, who, as a candidate, said he would re-enter the JCPOA and has not done so, and is making some other concessions now before he does so. So the people of Iran want a leader who will strengthen the economy within Iran and not rely on trade with nations that can't be counted on. So I think we will see some changes in that regard in Iran's stature and posture in the international community following this election.
Well, Mr. Fantina, I'm going to stay with you and go back to the original question, which was the issue of large voter turnout. At this point in time, how important is it to have a high voter turnout for the presidential election? Many say that the a large voter turnout, it displays a national unity to the adversaries of the Islamic Republic. Do you see it in that light as well?
Well, the adversaries are going to criticize the turnout, whether it's large or small. If it's large and the one candidate wins by a large amount, then the West will say it wasn't a fair election. See, it was manipulated so that this one candidate won an overwhelming amount of votes. If it's a small voter turnout, they'll say, now you see the people don't support the government, they don't support the candidates. So either way, on the international stage, the United States and its minions will criticize Iran. A large voter turnout would certainly indicate a strong show of support. But we have to remember that small voter turnouts, under 50%, are typical in many, many democracies. So the fact that this might be a lower turnout, from what I'm reading, than has been in decades in Iran, is not to be taken as an indication that the people don't support the government. They certainly do. Everything I have read, people I've talked to, people I know in Iran, there's tremendous support for the government. The small voter turnout may indicate that people weren't particularly thrilled with one candidate or another, or felt that any of the candidates would be certainly adequate. So I don't think it's anything that needs to be that the government of Iran needs to concern itself about too much, but the West will certainly use a large voter turnout or a small voter turnout to in some way criticize Iran.
Mr. Shajar, that's an interesting point that Mr. Fantina just brought up. Whatever the outcome, it seems that the United States, Western countries, the United States and its pals will have a pre-planned answer and pre-planned scenario. If it's a large voter turnout, if it's a small voter turnout, why are these countries seeking to undermine these efforts, these democratic efforts by Iran?
Well, look, there's always been this double standard and hypocrisy when it comes to U.S. policy and indeed Western policies in the region. And the reality is that, you know, while they sort of give an impression that they're there to promote democracy and so forth, you see that they have never, ever taken any action to promote democracy. As a matter of fact, they've done everything in their power to support dictators. You know, they have not supported anyone but dictators. You know, in the history of Iran, the example of Mossadegh, and it goes on and on. You know, and it's not just in Iran, everywhere else. Look around, see who are the darlings of the United States and the West. You know, Saudi king, Bahraini dictator who's actually committing war crimes. These are the reality of their priorities in the region. Look how they are helping and supporting bombing ordinary innocent people in Yemen and committing war crimes and creating the greatest catastrophe of our time. So when you look at this, then, you know, you shouldn't expect, we should not expect anything good out of their foreign policy for the region. As a matter of fact, you know, the creation of the democracy and the Islamic Revolution was done despite every effort they made to stop it. And when they couldn't stop it, they supported Saddam Hussein with chemical weapons and all sorts of weapons of mass destruction to defeat the democracy in Iran. So, yes, of course they're going to spend it. So if there is a large participation, they will spend it in one way. If there is any reduction, which they might be because of the fact of the corona and the fact that majority of people in Iran, and I've spoken to many, they believe that Mr. Raisi is going to win. So those who were going to support Raisi, they might not actually take the effort to go and vote because they think it's a done deal. Why should they go through these difficulties at the time of corona and so forth? And those who have been opponents of that, again, they've seen the fact that, you know, Mr. Raisi has been in forefront of the polls in such a major way. And if we sort of come to the end of this election and we see that Mr. Raisi has won with a huge majority, then that itself will explain if there is not as many people who participated in the election, because that was predicted by the electorate. And so some of them didn't see any point of actually going and voting because they already accepted that their wishes, their candidate is going to win. But despite anything, I mean, the sort of the level of the election participation in the West and everywhere else, even if it's reduced in Iran in comparison to previous election, it still is extremely respectable. And indeed, if Mr. Raisi wins with a sort of margin that's being sort of suggested in polls, it actually is extremely valuable and extremely legitimate win. And indeed will give him the endorsement to implement his policies.
Robert Fantina talking about the double standards of the West, namely the United States. They constantly try to put a question mark over Iran's elections and the democratic processes carried out by the Islamic Republic. And then on the other hand, the United States has its fair share of dictatorship, dictator buddies in, namely in the Persian Gulf region, namely all countries, all Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region. How do you explain that?
Well, it's completely hypocritical. The United States does not support democracy, and the people of Iran know that better than anybody else, because the United States overthrew their democratically elected government in 1953 and installed the Shah of Iran, who's a brutal and repressive multi-decade reign was finally defeated by the people of Iran. But the Shah had complete support of the United States during his entire reign. The United States is only interested in power and profits. And it finds that having dictators who will do its bidding, who will provide it with those countries' natural resources, who will allow the United States to establish military bases on their territories. This is what the United States wants. It doesn't want the people to be free, to be able to choose their own governments. We see this, as you mentioned, throughout the Persian Gulf, throughout the entire Middle East. A major example is Israel, which is an apartheid regime. Two very significant, world-renowned human rights organizations have recently, just this year, named it so. By any objective observation, it is a major violator of international law and human rights. And yet the United States supports that government with $4 billion annually, protects in the United Nations, isn't concerned about the injustice that exists within Israel and within the occupied Palestinian territories. So the United States pays lip service to things like international law and human rights when it is a major violator of human rights itself, not only within its own borders. Consider the treatment that people of color experience at the hands of the police departments, at the hands of hiring managers and so on. This is all very typical and a violation of human rights, but also the support it gives to Saudi Arabia for killing Yemenis, the decades-long war in Afghanistan, which is causing and has caused horrific suffering to the people there. The list is really quite endless. So the United States wants to project itself on the world stage as a beacon of freedom and democracy, but that lie is not believed much outside of its own borders.
So, Chajan, when we're talking about elections and democratic processes, the United States, for one, many believe is in no position to try and criticize other countries, and the reason would be their own election process, the Electoral College. And specifically this one, the most recent one, the weeks on counting and the historic shenanigans that happened, allegations of voter fraud, people living in glass houses, they shouldn't be throwing stones, should they?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's bizarre, the sort of chaos we had in the last election, indeed, even at the time of Gore and the election when, you know, majority of people voted for Gore, but then he did not, was chosen by Supreme Court to be the winner. So the fact of the matter is that, the elections in the United States is flawed, and indeed it's been called up to be flawed, and we saw the chaos that Trump created by sort of accusing the system of being fraudulent and everything else. But it's not just that. I mean, my colleague was talking about the internal problems of the United States. See, a system which 1% of the people have got resources of 85% of resources of the nation in their control. And so, therefore, 99% have been left almost with nothing to live on. That system has to be oppressive. That system has to have a police which actually behaves the way it's behaving, because that system, their police and their institutions, are there to preserve the right and the power and the economical well-being of that 1%. And so therefore, in some ways, it is right to even say it's an apartheid system, that ordinary people, the 99%, and those who are deprived of the resources, have been born into environment which they have no hope in hell to achieve anything, because that 1% got everything and the system is there to protect them. And so therefore, I don't think this idea that United States and, government by the people, for the people, and so forth, it really is just the empty words. The reality is that it's certain section of the society, i.e. that 1%, who benefit from everything, and the system is there to preserve that, not to bring justice for everyone, as we have seen over and over, not just over the issue of the Black Lives Matter, which is at the brunt of the sort of abuse, but even white lower class citizens in the United States. They don't count. They are not equal with everyone else, and they're not really being served by the same system. And so the hypocrisy of this whole thing of using the concept of democracy as a tool, weaponizing it, and then whoever you don't like, you actually accuse them of not being democratic, and whoever you like the Bahrainis and so forth, they're abusive dictatorship, which actually killing ordinary people who want more empowerment and democracy. And then who's implementing that? Who is actually supporting them? Who has got one of the biggest armed forces or naval bases in Bahrain? Who is sending, the police officers, ex-police officers from here are being sent to Bahrain to implement these abusive systems in abusing ordinary people who are asking for democracy. I mean, this level of hypocrisy, it's amazing. It's frightening that they actually could get away with this level of double standard and hypocrisy and hold a straight face.
Robert Fantina, your thoughts on the issue? A lot of, as Mr. Shajara just mentioned, it's surprising the hypocrisy and double standards that we're seeing when the United States tries to criticize other countries for their elections and the way that they are carried out. But then we have the Electoral College. As Mr. Shajara mentioned, the 2000 vote between Al Gore and George W. Bush. Al Gore, he won the popular vote. He lost the elections due to the intervention of the Supreme Court. Same thing happened in 2016, where Donald Trump lost the popular vote, but he won the presidency. Just trying to explain this to somebody, it's very difficult itself. And then you also have the other aspect that a single vote, for example, in somewhere like Rhode Island, where only has 4 electoral college votes, a single vote is worth far less than one vote is, for example, in the state of California or Florida. How can one say that the United States is for democracy and criticizes other countries' elections when there's so many holes in their own election process?
There are so many holes. And as you mentioned earlier, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, but the United States is forever heaving rocks at other countries despite its own glass house. And in 2000, as you mentioned, Al Gore won the popular vote by 500,000 votes. In 2016, Hillary Clinton won by over 3 million votes, and yet neither of those people became president. This inequality in the Electoral College, some states have more votes, some have fewer. This is not democracy. Democracy involves certainly more than just voting, but the voting aspect of it means that the candidate who wins the most votes wins that particular election, whether it's for a mayor of a small town or president of the United States. That is not the situation in the United States, not only at the national level, but also within states and local communities, when often, for example, a tie vote will be resolved not by having another vote, but by flipping a coin. This is not democracy. But the United States, as your other commentator so aptly mentioned, the 1%, the institutions of the United States exist to protect the 1%, and that 1% are the people in power. So they are not going to change anything. They're not going to change the Electoral College system because it works in their favor. They're not going to change U.S. foreign policy because it helps to enrich them. It helps to keep them powerful. So they don't mind crushing innocent people around the world as long as their profits and power remain strong.
Sure. Master Chajet, when these countries, they try to undermine, for example, with Iran, as you mentioned earlier, both of you alluded to the fact that the United States, it doesn't want democracy in Iran. It doesn't want democracy for any country in the region, for that matter. Help us understand why. What is there for them to gain by trying to put a question mark over, for example, democratic processes like the elections. What is there to gain for the United States, for its allies, by undermining democratic efforts and elections, for example, in Iran?
Not just in the region. I mean, let's go beyond that. Let's look at Venezuela. Let's look at
probably every region. Sort of,
it really is all over. And the only explanation and the only way to sort of look at this is the colonialism and the new colonialism. The fact of the matter is, United States, if it could have control over a country or a region, then it doesn't care how many people. Their stooges are killing, or what sort of havoc and chaos they are creating, or even if they're committing war crime. I look at the Zionist state. You know, Zionist state is committing all these acts of war crimes and everything else. Not only they don't care, but they actually support it. You know, they complain to international courts. When international courts trying to address these injustices, which are seen by every innocent, ordinary people around the world on the TV camera, the TV stations, and indeed everywhere else, social media, etc. It's not a secret that they are committing war crimes. They're killing children. They're killing, targeting civilians, destroying their homes. Ethnically cleansing it, and then they're going out in the sort of demonstration and shouting that only good Arabs are dead Arabs and so forth and so on. These sort of barbaric, sort of systematic racism, they support it in every way, at the United Nations, at the international courts, everywhere else. So it's not that even they are indifferent to the injustices that are being committed by their stooges. They actually encourage it and support it. Look at Saudi Arabia. They're not just encouraging and supporting this barbaric rule of a family over the whole nation, but they're actually even supporting their war crimes in Yemen. Or Bahrainis, their action against their own citizen who are asking for nothing more than more empowerment, more that word democracy. You know, these are the reason, the only reason, is explained through colonialism. Colonialism of past and colonialism of present is there to actually control and be in power in these regions and powers. And the only thing that matters is that. And things like human rights, things like democracy, things like empowerment, all these good words, all these concepts are there only as a tool to be used and misused and abused to serve the purpose of being in power as a colonial power in those regions, be it Middle East or South America or anywhere else.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. Shajar. You mentioned the issue of Israel, just the notion of believing that Israel is a democracy, that's a joke of grand proportions. Even Arabs, Palestinians born in Israel, living in Israel, they don't even have the equal rights as other Israelis have. So this is in no way is the Israeli regime a democracy, and yet their pals and chums with the United States.
You only look at the way that they treat this state, which is committing war crimes, killing children, imprisoning children. And if you're in any doubt that there is the apartheid state, just look at the number plates. Number plate of a Jewish person is identified completely different to number plate of anyone else who is not a Jew. And they could go certain places that others cannot go. They could drive in certain road that others cannot drive. I mean, the apartheid system is so embedded that you've got to be a fool not to see it.
But nevertheless, you know, in the United States, in Congress and in Senate, you know, all these pro-democratic, you know, sort of giants, you know, the champions and flag bearers of democracy and human rights, they stand up day in, day out supporting these atrocities against the ordinary Palestinians. And you know, I think the level of hypocrisy is very clear. But what is not clear is that some of us have not understood that this is nothing to do with the excuses that they make. This is all to do with the fact that the United States sees itself as the master of the universe, and they want to control it. And the only way they control it is that to make sure they have a stooges around that will do their bidding in those regions. And whoever doesn't will become non-democratic, will become human rights abuser, will become a bad person, will become acts of evil, etc., etc.
Robert Fantina, talk to us about that level of hypocrisy that we see specifically from the United States. We're focusing right now on the Israeli regime, the of how this apartheid system, it goes down, it's embedded to the core of the mentality of the Zionists, but they get billions of dollars of military aid yearly, even as they kill women and children, innocent women and children, unarmed women and children, and then for a turnaround, the United States likes to always undermine, for example, elections in Iran, put a big question mark over a democratic process as choosing a president or elections in Iran.
Okay, there are a couple things related to this. One, the United States wants to delegitimize democratic elections in Iran and other places so that when it decides to invade those countries, it can tell U.S. citizens that it must do it for to help the people, because they don't live in a democratic system, and they live in an oppressive system, and so the United States, the mighty United States, is going to go in and save them. So this enables the United States to come up with this excuse. And in the U.S., the U.S. citizenry generally always rallies around any war. They quickly become disillusioned with it, but initially, when the bombs start dropping, they support it. So delegitimizing elections gives the United States one reason for going in to bomb. Regarding Israel, the fact that Israel is an apartheid regime can't be denied by anybody. The country passed the nation-state law a couple of years ago, which says very clearly that Israel is the nation-state of the Jewish people and only the Jewish people. So their 20% of the population is Arab. So that this disenfranchises those people completely. It's an apartheid regime. The United States has made it very powerful because it wants an ally in there, in that part of the country, in that part of the world, that it can rely on to do its bidding. And also, we can't forget the importance, or we can't minimize the importance, of the pro-Israel lobby in the United States. These lobby groups donate millions upon millions of dollars to candidates to get them elected. And then once the candidates are elected, the lobby groups write legislation for the candidate to introduce. This has been very successful, worked very successfully for pro-Israel lobbies for a number of years. We are seeing significant cracks in that today, but it has been a method that has been used. The elected officials from the present on down aren't concerned about human rights. They're concerned about getting reelected. And pro-Israel lobbies support their reelection campaigns financially very generously, so they'll overlook anything.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. We're going to bring this segment to an end. Political commentator Masoud Shajare joining us from London. Thank you for your comments. Also, author and journalist Robert Fantina joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Gentlemen, I appreciate your time. Well, Iranians have gone to the polls to elect.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the special coverage of Iran's 13th presidential election, and you just heard a discussion on election at Press TV headquarters. Again, for your information, polls have opened nationwide in Iran's 2021 presidential election. Over 59.3 million Iranians are eligible to vote for one of the four candidates running. Polls opened across the country at 7 a.m. local time on Friday, June 18th, and will run until 12 a.m. on Saturday